recordings from Jewish musical traditions across multiple generations, from Yiddish folk songs to instrumental klezmer, Yiddish theater, and contemporary performances. It's a grand tour of many musical landscapes. That's Borscht Beat, an hour of Jewish music in the Catskills, Sunday afternoons at 1 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, W233 AH Monticello. You're listening to Radio Catskill, celebrating 30 years of public radio for the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania. Listen to us on your smartphone. Just download the WJFF app.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Two Queens, offering coffee, tea, and bees. Located in Pete's Plaza, Narrowsburg, New York. TwoQueensCoffee.com. And from listeners like you.
Good morning. Welcome to Catskill Character. I'm your host, Donna Fellenberg. And with me today is Narrowsburg resident John Olson, who will tell us a bit about himself and how he ended up being the aide-de-camp to Frederick Robinson Koch, eldest son of Fred Chase Koch, founder of Koch Industries. The Koch family is considered the third wealthiest family in the United States. Unlike his brothers Charles and David, Fred had no interest in the family oil business, preferring to devote his life to the arts, education, and historic preservation. With John's help, we'll get a glimpse into the life of this extremely intelligent, highly educated man who had to battle his own family in court in a struggle over the huge holdings of the Koch family. Frederick ended up with 14% of the Koch fortune. He was able to pursue his passions for the arts and education. He served on the boards of the Metropolitan Opera, the Spoleto Music Festival in Charleston, South Carolina, and the Film Society of Lincoln Center. He made numerous bequests to independent theaters in New York and London, mostly anonymously, as well as libraries and museums and universities. And for the last 15 years of his life, he did all of these things with the help of his most trusted friend and aide-de-camp, my guest today, John Olson.
John, I'm so happy to have you on Catskill Character today. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
You know, before we begin to talk about Frederick, let's start with you. Please give the listener like a little snapshot of your early life.
It was nothing really remarkable. I grew up in Dayton, Ohio. My dad was literally a rocket scientist working for the Air Force. And my mom was an administrator at a medical school at a local university. And, you know, spent a pretty normal childhood there. And then when I graduated from college, I moved to New York.
Where did you go to college?
I went to Miami of Ohio, which we like to say was a school before Florida was a state. I wanted to work in marketing and advertising, and I'd gotten a job with a big international public relations firm called Manning, Selvage & Lee. And they had big clients like Johnson Wax and General Motors and Procter & Gamble. And they gave me a job on the Johnson Wax account, and I had to meet the account team and the account director in Racine, Wisconsin, a couple of weeks after I graduated. So I flew out there and met them and got a briefing on the product that I was supposed to be working on over the summer. I just knew that I would be traveling over the summer, and I didn't know a lot more about it. But it turned out that the product was Raid Bug Spray, a new product by Raid Bug Spray. And the job was to drive the Raid Mobile, which was a big van all around the country. And inside the van was a robotic cockroach that was 5'5" tall, I think 350 pounds. And it could answer questions in English and Spanish about how to get rid of cockroaches in your home or how to get rid of fleas. And so that was my first job. And, you know, all my friends were, you know, going to law school or working for Arthur Anderson or something. And it got great amusement out of the fact that I was driving the Raid Mobile across the country.
So I'm guessing you didn't stay there very long. What did you do after that?
My immediate boss left, and she recommended that I go work for her former boss, who just opened her own agency, you know, and one, you know, sort of one job led to another, like most people. And then I ended up moving over to the client side, and I worked for Ralph Lauren for a couple of years, who had been a client, and then moved from there to Tommy Hilfiger. And I was at Tommy for about 10 years. I started as a marketing manager and left as a senior vice president. And I really loved it. I had a great experience there. And then I went on to David Yurman, the jeweler. I was the head of marketing and advertising at David Yurman, but I was only there for about 20 minutes, and it really was not a good fit.
Oh.
I didn't like them, and they didn't like me any better. So I quit, took some time off, and that's when I thought, I like cars and houses and dogs and trees and gardening, and I don't have any of those things in my life in Manhattan, living in a white box, trying to sell people things they don't need. So we bought a house in the woods, got a golden retriever and a four-wheel drive, and I spent the next year or so on eBay buying antlery things and filling it up to make it feel like a cabin in the woods, you know, which it is.
I know you really enjoyed working for Tommy Hilfiger for those 10 years, but what really appears to have changed your life was your chance encounter with Frederick Koch. And I'm saying Frederick Koch because I know that he preferred to differentiate himself from his father, who was Fred Koch, but you called him Fred, so we're going to call him Fred.
Okay.
Would you recollect for us how you met and your first impression of Mr. Koch?
Sure. I had some older friends named Douglas and Marion Campbell, who were in their 70s, I think, probably when I was in my 20s, and Fred was maybe in his mid-50s. And they had a fantastic penthouse apartment on Fifth Avenue and 71st Street overlooking the Frick Museum in Central Park. And they would have this big lunch every spring, a sit-down lunch on their terraces for like 70 people maybe. And I was invited one year and sat next to someone named Fred Koch. And he was so interesting and funny. And, you know, I had no idea what his background was, really. I came to know, of course, over the years. But he always had kind of a twinkle in his eye, like the cat that swallowed the canary. And he was full of questions. He's always asking other people questions, talking very little about himself. And we just, you know, slowly developed a friendship. And he would invite me to, you know, to go see a new play or go see a new film, you know, at the Film Forum or go to the opera. And I would always try to, you know, reciprocate in some way, whether it was paying for a taxi or taking him to dinner if I could afford to do it at the time. And I think he appreciated, and I would have done that with anyone, you know, really, but, and always sending a thank you note, of course. And we just developed this friendship and continued on in that way for, you know, many years.
I think it's really important to note that you were friends for many years before you started working for Fred as his aide-de-camp. Do you think it was hard for him to trust people?
I think it definitely was. I think he was kind of a naturally, I don't know if that's true, naturally distrustful person, or if that must be something that, you know, a characteristic that develops in certain people with their own experiences. But I think my observation is that, you know, he was immensely rich most of his life, and people tried to take advantage, whether intentional or not. You know, if we were out somewhere, inevitably an acquaintance would come up and gush all over him and, you know, and be thrilled with trying to introduce him to their friends and that kind of thing. And there just always seemed like there was an angle and it wasn't sincere. So I think he just developed kind of a shell and was very circumspect and suspect about new people who came into his life until he was pretty sure that they weren't after, you know, something.
Well, Fred was attached to objects, but not just for the aesthetic value, but he loved the stories that each of these objects told. Let's just take a moment and talk about his estates and the efforts that he personally took in the historic preservation of these incredible places.
He did. He had a major collector of fine arts, decorative arts, photography, and these beautiful houses around the world. And I think one of the first ones that he bought and restored was called Sutton Place, which is rumored to be where Henry VIII met Anne Boleyn, a beautiful Tudor mansion outside of London, about 20 miles. And he also had an incredible villa in the south of France called Villa Torre Clementina in Cap Martin, Roquebrun. He had a castle in Austria called Schloss Blumbach, which belonged to Franz Ferdinand at the time of his assassination at Sarajevo, triggering World War I. He had a beautiful, we still have the foundation. I'll talk more about that later, but the beautiful town of Woolworth Mansion on East 80th Street in New York City, and then an immense Gothic Tudor mansion in outside of Pittsburgh called Elm Court. He loved each of these houses really for the architecture and their history and filled them with objects that were appropriate for the style of the house and the period. So at Blumenbach, for example, it's filled with Austrian and German, you know, rare furniture and artwork. The house in Pittsburgh is filled with American and English antiques. The house in New York is in the French Regency style, so it's filled with beautiful French furniture and European paintings. They all are very different, and he had a real, as I said, a scholarly approach to how he collected things.
You know, I have a question about that. It just occurred to me now. So he wasn't going out antiquing. How did he find these pieces of furniture that were appropriate for each of these historic places?
He had an agent in London who was excellent. And this particular guy was a real expert in, you know, he's an art expert. And he would bring things to Fred's attention and say, you know, this is an unusual painting by this particular artist because X, Y, Z. So Fred collected things that were outstanding and really, really unusual for some of the artists that he collected. And he just had a great eye. They would get four or five different auction catalogs from Christie's and Sotheby's and dealers in London and, you know, Munich and all over the world, sending him these things. And if you pore through them over and over again for long enough, you also develop an eye.
Mm-hmm.
Makes it difficult for me now to go shopping for artwork because my eye for it has changed myself just in the things that I've been exposed to through Fred.
Did you spend time in each of those places or did you not visit all of them?
I did not visit Sutton Place in England. He'd invited me, but I was, you know, working a lot at the time and just couldn't take the time away to go when he would be there. And I visited Torre Clementina. I was there last summer, actually, in the south of France. But when Fred was alive, he'd invited me. But also, you know, I had a full-time job and I wasn't able to travel when he was there. But I've seen all the others, of course. I worked at on 80th Street for Fred. That's where my office was. Visited the house in Pittsburgh many, many, many times, dozens of times. And also Blumenbach in Austria many times.
You know, what's interesting about that is that he had all these incredible places, but he lived in an apartment in New York that was not at all remarkable.
It's true. He loved the process of creating these incredible environments, making these houses better than they ever were originally. But he didn't need to live there. He lived in a relatively, in a fabulous Fifth Avenue building, but in a relatively modest apartment, a two-bedroom, two-bath apartment that was, you know, done in the 1970s and filled with his own clutter the way any of our homes are. So it wasn't, while the other houses are just pristine and real show places, this was really his nest. It took me a year to empty it after he died.
You know, I think this would be a good place for us to take a break. And when we come back, I know you've got some great memories and great stories about Fred that would be so wonderful for the listener to hear. So let's take a break. You're tuned into Catskill Character with today's guest, John Olson, aide-de-camp to Fred R. Koch, who passed away on February 12, 2020. We'll be right back with more from John, so stay tuned.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Garnet Health Medical Center, Catskills. Garnet Health, going above and beyond to elevate care every day for every person. Learn more at garnethealth.org. Exceptional lives here. And from The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Radio Catskill, keeping you connected with the local edition.
It's just been an incredibly tumultuous year in state politics.
Weeknights at 6:30.
One important step in decarbonizing the state economy is making the electrical grid zero carbon.
Right after All Things Considered.
From a young age, I've really been interested in supporting dairy products and help really in any way, and being a dairy princess is the best that I can do to do that.
The local edition on Radio Catskill.
Hello, if you're a book reader, and even if you're not, I'd like to invite you to join me, Aaron Hicklin, every Sunday at noon for Shelf Life on WJFF Radio Catskill, a show about books and the people who love them. Each episode, my guest picks two of their favorite books. I read them, and then we get together to talk about them. That's Shelf Life on Sundays at noon on WJFF Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Catskill Character. My guest today is John Olson of Narrowsburg, New York. John was a dear friend, and for the 15 years up until he died in 2020, the aide-de-camp to the late Fred R. Koch, oldest son of Fred Chase Koch, founder of Koch Industries, the second largest privately held company in the U.S. Fred R. Koch, born in Wichita, Kansas in 1935, preferred a life devoted to the arts, education, and philanthropy, rather than the family oil business. He graduated from Harvard with a BA in Humanities, joined the Navy, and then studied playwriting at the Yale School of Drama. One of his passions became the assembling of important collections of literary and musical works and the restoring of historical properties around the world, one of which was Schloss Blumenbach in Austria, former estate of Archduke Franz Ferdinand. In the second half of the show, John Olson will share some wonderful, colorful memories of this remarkable man, Fred Robinson Koch. Let's get back to it. John, you have a great story about the time you were in Austria. Could you tell us about it?
I was. You typically go almost every summer to visit Fred. When he would be in Austria for the entire summer, usually June through September, and loved the Salzburg Festival, which was in Salzburg, about half an hour away from Blumenbach. So typically when we were there, we would go to a performance every evening, and on the weekends, also maybe a matinee in the morning or early afternoon, and then go back in the evening for another performance. So if you weren't a music lover, it was kind of a chore, but to go with Fred was to learn to love classical music. So one Saturday morning, we were on our way, and he said, "We have to come right back after the performance today because Sir Dennis and Lady Thatcher are coming for lunch." And I said, "Margaret Thatcher?" And he said, "Yes, of course." As if, you know, what other Thatcher? And it turned out that they were house guests of a woman, a husband and wife that Fred knew who lived on the other side of the mountain. And they had been there before, I think. Or at least I know they came back another time, at least once. But sure enough, we came back. And I thought, how can I get out of going to this concert and try to find an American biography of Margaret Thatcher so I can cram in the next 3 hours and have something intelligent to talk with her about when she got there. But she was very nice. She was quite grandmotherly, I thought. I mean, tiny. I expected a big, tall person like Julia Child, but she was only about, 5 feet or 5'2". Looked like a good wind would pick her up by the hair and carry her away. Mm-hmm. And her husband was very, very sweet. You could tell they had a sweet relationship. They held hands as Fred walked them through the castle, and it was interesting. I mean, they were very, very nice. And then at one point during the lunch, someone asked her about, what do you think of this Saddam Hussein and his weapons of mass destruction? And she turned into kind of a different person. You could see a little switch like flip over in her forehead, and she leaned forward and kind of hammered the table and said, what, we have to reframe the conversation. This is about a third world dictator enriching himself on the backs of the people. And it really was so passionate. So it was a cool thing to see.
Wow. I'm just thinking of comparing your life here in the Catskills, which is wonderful. And then going over there and experiencing that, it must have been kind of mind blowing for you at times.
It was. From that to, he was a good friend of Barry and Liz Humphreys. And Barry Humphreys, of course, is Dame Edna. I go to the Metropolitan Opera one night and then the next week go to see Dame Edna and then go down afterward and meet him in the dressing room. He was really a partook in every possible kind of culture. He saw every film, every play, but every book. He just absorbed so much culture.
So for many years you were his friend, but you did eventually begin to work for him. How did that happen?
I think in the fall of 2006, he'd been on a trip with a group to India, and I think he caught some kind of a bug, and he got quite ill, and they thought he might have lung cancer or something. He was in the hospital for about 2 weeks and had lost a lot of weight, and just coincidentally, his former assistant quit and moved to England. And I had the flexibility at the time to help him. And he said, you know, can you just come and help me for a couple weeks until I can poach some kid from Sotheby's, which I think is what he typically would have done to try to find a new assistant or right-hand man. And so I said, sure. So I went and started working at the office, which is in this spectacular townhouse on East 80th Street. And it was so interesting and so much fun. And we got along so well. The phone never rang. There were no status reports, no clients, no budgets, really. And I ended up staying until he died in February 2020. So it was a long and very successful relationship.
And I guess that harkens back to what we were talking about earlier about his ability to trust people. He already knew he could trust you. He had been friends with you for so long. So it was like a perfect fit. And it worked out so nicely for both of you.
It did.
I love the story you told me recently about Fred and William and the America's Cup. Would you tell that story?
Sure. Fred had three younger brothers, and the brothers three and four were twins, David Koch and Bill Koch. And Bill is a wonderful sailor still. And Fred called me one day and said, you know, do you have cable television? He wouldn't pay for cable. You know, just had regular channel 2, channel 7.
Oh, that's funny.
I don't even know what the reception must have been terrible. But he said, do you have cable? And I said, I do. And do you have ESPN? I do. Well, could I come over on Saturday and watch the America's Cup? Because my brother Billy has a boat in the America's Cup. And I said, sure. So he came over and we ordered a pizza and watched the America's Cup. And Bill won the America's Cup.
Wow.
I think it was 1992. And yeah. Fred was so excited and so proud of him. And, you know, it was terrific.
I know you, and I know you have a wonderful sense of humor. It's very droll at times. You love making people laugh. I was wondering about Fred. What was his humor like? Could he laugh at himself?
He did. He was so intelligent. I mean, he would laugh at anecdotes on a level that I probably wouldn't even understand, you know, but things about, you know, Cole Porter lyrics or, you know, lines in old movies or whatever. But one of my favorite stories is one day I went in I'd meet with him every day at 2 o'clock, and I went in at 2 o'clock one day to meet with him. And he said, I need you to call the bank and ask them for a check for 500,000 British pounds. I said, all right, you know, what city? The bank always asked me, what city? He said, London. I said, okay, and to who is the payee? And he said, it's called the billiard room, all right? Then he said, well, don't you want to know why? And I said, okay, I'll bite. Why? And he said, I found the most remarkable billiard table. It was made to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the coronation of Queen Victoria. And it has, the panels are carved with all the British crown colonies and the British Navy, and the pockets have carvings of British monarchs over the last 1,000 years or something, you know. And so he was buying this billiard table for 500,000 pounds, which at that day, the conversion rate, it was the equivalent of $806,000, which is mind blowing for a billiard table. And he didn't even play pool, and he already had Franz Ferdinand's billiard table. So he, a little later in the conversation, he said, well, are you leaving now? Are you going up to the office? And I said, no, I've got to go run an errand downtown, but I'll be up later this afternoon. He said, well, do you mind if I ride with you? And I said, sure, you know, it's fine. And I suddenly realized, oh, he just assumed that I was going to take a taxi, where I probably would have taken the subway or the bus. But I never, ever once in 30 years saw him pay for a taxi. So we walked out the front door, and the doorman said, you know, would you like a taxi, Mr. Koch? And he said, we would. And the doorman went out to hail a cab. And Fred turned to me and said, do you have a pen? And I said, I do. I handed him my pen, and he bent over and he started digging a nickel out of the asphalt in front of his Fifth Avenue building. Taxi pulled up. He, you know, broke my pen. We got in the cab. He didn't get the nickel. And I said, Fred, you know, you really shouldn't do that. You're going to get hit by the Fifth Avenue bus. It'll be in your obituary. It'd be very embarrassing for the whole family. And he laughed and he said, oh, the fatal nickel.
Oh, God. The fatal nickel.
Fatal nickel, you know, and he was laughing at himself. And
that is so crazy, John.
He recognized the absurdity of it, but also, you know, I don't know if he realized, you know, the irony of the same day of, you know, buying an $800,000 pool table. And
exactly. Wow. Well, it's almost 2 years since Fred died. What do you miss most about him?
That is easy. Every day when I would go in to meet with him, before I even sat down, usually we'd meet in this little room off the lobby of his apartment building. And he'd say, you know, did you read the book review this morning? Did you watch TCM last night? Did you renew your membership to the 59 East 59th Street Theater? Did you renew your membership to the York? He would grill me about all these different things and sort of insist that I read a particular book or went to see a particular film. And I miss that a lot because he was so erudite and so knowledgeable. He changed my life in that way. I mean, he just opened these doors, introducing me to different authors and playwrights and, you know, types of furniture, or, you know, types of china, who knows, you know, all these things that I never would have had access to without his influence. So I missed that the most. And I, you know, I just, he was something else. He was a real character and such a, you know, such an important part of my adult life from my 20s into my 50s.
How are you going to safeguard his legacy?
When he died, his will established two different foundations. One is based in Austria and the other is in the United States. And the foundation in Austria is dedicated to the preservation of Schloss Blumbach. And it's a very important Austrian cultural landmark. So that the purpose of that foundation will be largely associated with preservation of the castle and its Habsburg history. And then the American Foundation, which is called the Frederick R. Koch Foundation, is largely, he left a very broad mandate for the support of artists and the arts. It's a longer mission statement than that, but that's it in a nutshell. And it's in its infancy, and there are three lifetime trustees. I'm one of three. And we are, you know, it's in formation. We're trying to figure out what specifically we'll do, but we will, for now, preserve the estate in Pittsburgh, which is called Elm Court, preserve the mansion in New York City so that they can be used for some public benefit. And we have begun to allow some nonprofits to use the houses for limited kind of fundraising events, or we have partnered with the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center to host some musical events at 80th Street and have produced some of our own, which you can see on YouTube. There's a series called Live from Elm Court on YouTube where you can see a lot of the musical performances that we've produced ourselves there early on in COVID. And that was an effort to get some money into the hands of young performing artists who otherwise would not have been able to gather and, you know, do their art. And eventually we hope to establish scholarships in areas that were of interest to Fred, whether it's photography or landscape design or architecture, theater, literature, all these different areas. So that's the goal over probably the next 10 years is to establish these scholarships.
Well, that sounds fantastic. And I just want to thank you so much, John, for coming in today and sharing all your memories and these stories with us. I really appreciate it. It was really fun having you on.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Donna.
This has been Catskill Character with today's guest, John Olson of Narrowsburg, New York. Catskill Character is on every Saturday at 11:30, right after Farm and Country. Please tune in next week for another conversation with a fabulous character of the Catskills on WJFF Radio Catskill. I'm Donna Fellenberg. Thanks so much for listening.
I love that it's on after Farm and Country.
Yes, that's perfect, isn't it?
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Two Queens, offering coffee, tea, and bees. Located in Pete's Plaza, Narrowsburg, New York. TwoQueensCoffee.com. And from listeners like you.
WJFF Jeffersonville.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. This week, we walk through the gate of summer by visiting three cooks in three very different parts of the country to see what June tastes like for them. We'll hear about the shrimp of coastal Georgia, the salmon of Alaska, the preserves of Appalachia, and more. Coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
This is Thane Peterson, host of WJFF's Living Jazz Show. Every Friday from noon to 2, I bring you the very best of the current jazz scene with a little bit of classic jazz thrown into the mix. This music will warm your heart and soothe your soul. Please join me for Living Jazz.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Never Sink General Store, featuring an award-winning chef, smoked barbecue year-round, local products and catering, now offering takeout. NeverSinkGeneralStore.com. And from listeners like you.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. WJFF Jeffersonville. W233 AH Monticello.